Okay, it's May 23rd, 2006, and I'm David Brooks, the interviewer for the University of Montana's Oral History Project. Today I'm interviewing Mr. Gordon Browder, who's a longtime professor and chair of the Sociology Department at the university. Mr. Browder, thanks for talking with us today, and I'd like for you to start maybe by telling a little bit of your personal and academic background, what brought you to Missoula in the first place.
Well, I graduated as an undergraduate from the University of Virginia in 1936 as an English major. I started graduate work in sociology at the University of North Carolina in the fall of 1936. Even though I had not had any background in sociology, but this was in the middle of the Depression, of course, and you sort of seized what came along. And the North Carolina offer contained a pretty good stipend, which got me there. I got my master's degree in sociology in 1941. And a Ph.D. In 1943. My first academic job was at the University of Texas, and I was a member of the faculty, the sociology faculty there, until I went into the Army in 1943. When I came out of the service, I took a temporary job at the University of Florida as a favor to a friend of mine who was not able to get out of the service and pick up his duties at Florida. And I stayed at the University of Florida for 2 years. In 1947, I had a call from the president's office at the University of Montana, asking me if I'd be interested in applying for a job at Missoula. I said I would be, and the upshot of it was that I did accept the position here as professor of sociology and chairman of the department. And I and my family came to Missoula in the winter of 1948. Not a good time to come to Montana from Florida, I might say, especially since that was a particularly hard winter. At any rate, I came here in 1948, and I've been here ever since. When I first came, the sociology department as a separate entity was new. Sociology courses had been taught as part of the economics curriculum in the Department of Economics, but a new department was set up that included sociology, anthropology, and social welfare. And for several years, we operated as a three major department. Then a bit later, social welfare split off and formed the Department of Social Work, which I believe now is called the School of Social Work. And a year or so after that, anthropology split off and formed the present anthropology department. So what began as three different academic areas eventuated in three differently administered departments. And it's, as far as I know, has remained like that ever since. So with that sort of beginning then, I embarked on a career that kept me at the University of Montana for the next 30 years.
So you mentioned moving from being an English major to a sociology major, mm-hmm. and then shortly thereafter we see the University of Montana develop a specific sociology, anthropology, and social welfare department out of the economics department. What was it about that time in the nation during the Depression that also was present in Missoula that was making those changes happen so that you personally would change fields and the university would move in that direction?
Well, of course, all over the country, universities were growing after the war. Enrollments were growing pretty rapidly in those days. I think that the social sciences, which really had not had a great deal of emphasis during the war years, began to generate a good bit more interest and concern around the country. So it was sort of a natural function, I suppose, of growth and development, not only here, but at other universities too. The growth in all three of these areas that I mentioned was quite substantial in the years after the war. And even though I've been retired now for almost 30 years, I gather that they still, all three areas, still attractive to students. The enrollments have stayed high. And as far as my change in academic areas was concerned, I suppose if in 1936, when I graduated from the University of Virginia, somebody had come along and offered me a nice fellowship to do graduate work in an English department somewhere, I certainly would have taken it. But I wasn't so fortunate. Somebody did come along and offer me a substantial fellowship to do graduate work in sociology, and so I took it. I certainly wouldn't like to leave the impression on anybody that I'm cavalier, or was cavalier in those days, about which particular academic area I was in. I would have preferred to stay in English if I had a chance to do so. But I think that anybody who grew up and remembers the Depression years would realize that there was a certain, sense of opportunism. You sort of seized the best thing that came along, especially if you didn't have any money when you had just graduated from university. So I guess that's not a very satisfactory answer, but I think it's fairly honest one as far as I'm concerned.
It certainly makes sense. And could you talk a little bit about when you moved into sociology, what your research interests or pursuits were, and then how you brought those into the University of Montana to start this new department?
I was trained mostly as a graduate student in quantitative sociology, that is a particular field, about to mention it, was population study, demography. And I did my graduate research in population and wrote my master's thesis and dissertation. Both were concerned with demographic data. And I brought that same emphasis to Montana. However, when you're starting a brand new department and there are certain courses that have to be offered and you have a limited faculty to cover them, then everybody teaches not necessarily what he'd prefer to teach, but what he can teach. And there was a good bit of that here at Montana in the early days. One of the areas that I sort of picked up along the way was criminology, and it so happened that there was a good bit of interest in criminological and correctional matters in the state at that time, and so I gravitated to that area and liked it, sort of took to it. And so during my teaching career, in the department, then criminology and corrections, penology, criminal justice, got to be one of my major areas, and I did a good bit of work in those fields. I worked at the prison for a while in the educational program over there, and for 18 years or so, I was chairman of the state Board of Crime Control, and so criminology sort of became my major interest here at Montana.
And so did it also become a major emphasis of the department as a whole? And
yes.
Mm-hmm. Who was the original faculty? What was the curriculum you started with and soon thereafter built on?
Well, originally, we had two or three courses in criminal justice. Excuse me, the introductory course in criminology. Cut that off. Anyway, I need some water. I'll be back and pick up on. We have had when I got here, I don't remember all of the courses specifically. There was an introductory course in criminology. There was an introductory course in juvenile delinquency, and I think that was about it. But the courses that we expanded as we became a separate department and got additional staff, and so we added our courses then in the general area of criminology, and they attracted a lot of students, and so eventually we developed a strong emphasis on social justice, criminal justice areas in the department. And although you'd want to check this out for yourself, I think that now the department probably has something that corresponds to a pretty strong major in the criminal justice area. I haven't kept up with the development of courses over there for a long time, so I don't know for sure, but my impression is that that's the case. And the good bit of interest is still maintained. Even before I retired, a lot of the students took sociology with this criminology emphasis because they wanted to go into such careers as probation, parole officers, or correctional officers and penal institutions, that sort of thing. And we did turn out a lot of people that went into those particular jobs, types of jobs.
Why do you suspect that was the interest of students and then obviously of the department here in Montana? You mentioned that it was
well,
popular in the state.
I suppose it was pretty general. This might sound a little shallow, but anything with crime or sex in it is going to be attractive, not only to university students, but to the population at large. And I think one reason why students sort of flocked to the criminology course was that crime is sort of a romantic concept. You know, you like to read about murders and rapes and arson, this sort of that might not be fair, but
it makes the news.
Yeah. I could say the same thing about a course in courtship and marriage that we had for many years. I don't know whether it's still being taught or not, but that also attracted students. The courses were quite large. We'd run even in my day, would run sometimes to 100 people in a course. And I think that the subject matter was attractive. I never had the impression that the academic substance of the course was nearly as seductive as the idea that you got to look at the pictures of the reproductive organs of men and women. You might not want to include that, but anyhow.
You know, you're talking about post-war years and early 50s and the student body. And can you talk a little bit about the student body at that time and, you know, how much of it was the growth about, you know, the GI Bill, people yeah. coming back from the war? How much, you know, if you have a course on courtship and marriage, how much of your student body was women at the time or increasingly so?
Well, I don't know. I couldn't give you anything near an exact breakdown, but certainly there were a lot of women students, not only in that course, but in sociology courses generally, because we had the social work emphasis, later the separate sociology department. Social work students took sociology courses as sort of a basis and background for their later professional training. So we always had at least 50%, and my guess is more, women enrolled in courses than men. And I think that was probably true up and down the line with all of the courses. As far as the general student body, I was very much impressed, very well impressed, with university students coming back to school after the war. I think some of the best students I ever had were at the University of Florida, returning veterans, and then the same thing was true when I got here. I thought the returning veterans made almost ideal students because they were pretty serious about being able to get into college or to be back in college. And they were very conscientious, just very, very satisfying students to have from an instructor's point of view. And I felt that as the body of veterans of ex-World War II people began to diminish, that somehow the quality, this might be an unfair evaluation, but somehow the quality of my students wasn't quite as substantial, as solid as it was earlier.
But, and you link that to them being older students or having
older,
the war experience?
Exactly. They were older. They had their war experiences behind them. I don't know whether they attained more maturity during the war years than they would have if they hadn't gone to war, but they seemed more mature. They seemed more concerned with the substance of things. They really wanted to get as much as they could out of their university or college experiences. And from that standpoint, they were very satisfactory students.
Do you recollect any specific examples to illustrate that of student projects or individual students' relationships you had or in the courses you taught?
Well, no, not specifically so much. It was really more like sort of an atmosphere that surrounded students generally. The returning veterans seemed to have an influence even on those people who were not veterans. There were enough of them so that they formed sort of a core, a group of serious people who was sort of no-nonsense. They didn't come to the university to play. They came to the university to get what they could out of it. And that seemed to sort of filter to a certain extent into other students. Again, it was from my standpoint, it was sort of a different sort of student culture that was characterized by a more serious concern with what they were doing, less interest in the byproducts of the university, or the having fun aspects of the university. And I don't suppose that we've ever had that particular sort of student culture in our schools before. And, well, I started to say, I hope we don't have the circumstances that produce it again, but who knows about that? There'll be undoubtedly a lot of Iraqi war veterans coming back, but we don't know about that.
So, you know, the students weren't as interested in the, as you say, byproducts or entertainment aspects of college or university life at the time. Were there any unique organizations or activities that arose because of that different demographic?
I can't think of any. The first instance that I can recall of a change, and that was brought about by a different attitude and a different set of values, was the influence of the what we call sometimes the hippie generation. That did cause a very, very visible, palpable changes in the social structure of the campus population and in the behavior. It's true that here at Montana, we never had the very serious troubles with rebellion against authority and destruction of campus property, that sort of thing. I guess the most serious, at least the most spectacular example we had was when a group of students captured the ROTC headquarters. You probably know all about that. And they burned some documents. I don't think they did a great deal of damage, but it was pretty spectacular for Montana. And the president addressed them from the steps of Main Hall, and it really wasn't anything compared, let's say, to the student uprisings at Columbia University or some of the California schools. But it was pretty rich stuff for Missoula and the University of Montana. There was a very definite a change in the character of the place. A little personal anecdote. I had a friend who had been to the university many years before and had been in the military and was a very patriotic individual. And we were walking across the campus to lunch one day, and a student with long, dirty-looking hair hanging down to his shoulders, dressed in an old Army field jacket, which still had sergeant stripes on the shoulder, on the sleeves. And this chap practically went through the roof. He saw it. This was absolutely against every value system he had. It was unpatriotic. It was demeaning to the military. It was as bad as burning the flag. And whenever this particular individual saw a person like that, and there were a good many of them on the campus back in the 70s, then he had the same sort of attitude. And so there was enough of the hippie culture that had became injected into the local situation, so that some people got pretty upset about it.
How about in the faculty? You went off into the Army and then returned to the academic world. Mm-hmm. How about other faculty on campus, and what effect did that have, both in faculty leaving and then as they came back
from the
war?
I don't think a particularly important impact. There were some faculty members who were certainly much more sympathetic to the rebellious spirit of a lot of students. Some faculty members sort of identified themselves with students, the more extreme instances. Some of the younger faculty members actually began to emulate the dress of the hippie, so-called hippies, too. But my recollection is that, by and large, it didn't really affect the faculty very much. One member of my own department came to the university here from one of the California schools because he got tired of the uprisings and the cutting of class and the general what he thought of as misbehavior of the students at the California school, and he was impressed by how quiet things were around here, how docile and non-rebellious the student body seemed to be. So, but I don't think the faculty was affected much. It certainly didn't have any impact on my department, either in terms of the faculty or students. And things went on pretty much as usual during the hippie years. And I had a son at Columbia University at the time that the worst of the student uprisings there took place. And there, they simply closed down the whole university for a period of time. Mm-hmm. Called in the riot police, and things are pretty quiet here.
And why was the University of Montana isolated from that extreme of a reaction, do you suspect?
Well, I don't know. Maybe it's, you said isolated, maybe it's physical, relative physical isolation might have had something to do with it. Maybe the fact that we were comparatively small, maybe there simply was not the core of student leadership, insurgency type of leadership on the campus. I don't know. And it's a little hard, really, looking back on it, to judge why things didn't get more disrupted than they did. And other people might have a different impression of it, but from where I sat and in my own recollections, certainly don't recall any serious trouble. And students would cut class, so they'd get drunk, but they got drunk anyway, you know. and they did, a bunch of them did descend on the ROTC headquarters, but well, that was pretty small potatoes compared to what was going on in other parts of the country. So.
To rewind a little bit, there's something I've heard about the 50s in terms of being sort of an intellectual revolution that largely came out of the study of sociology, and how that intellectual revolution was somewhat of a critique of the suddenly booming middle class in post-war affluence, and it brings to mind works like William White's The Organization Man,
yeah,
or John Kenneth Galbraith's The Affluent Society, The Lonely Crowd, books like that that really came out of the study of sociology. How much of that was an influence on the department here? How much of that did you absorb and became part of the curriculum or student interests?
Well, undoubtedly, individual faculty incorporated as much or as little of that particular sort of material as they chose to. I taught one course for a while called Formal Organizations, and I found some of that material very useful. The Organization Man, for example, was a fairly colorful example you could use in class as to how a particular sort of organizational structure tends to produce certain personality types that go down even to how people dress and whether they wear neckties to work or not and so on. Yeah, sociologists certainly, sociologists wrote some of that material, and certainly other sociologists used it. I don't think that it represented a major trend or major emphasis in the field of sociology, but it certainly was useful and quite appropriate for certain courses. And there was a good bit of that sort of material coming out in those days.
How did that sort of material reverberate with students who were at a relatively isolated geographically university, like the University of Montana, a somewhat small rural Western community, when these works are about suburbanization and interstate highways and large corporations?
Yeah, I suspect it at the time, and I think I was probably correct, that for a lot of students, it really wasn't very realistic. They did not come out of a background or had not had the sort of experiences that would bring them in contact with that type of social organization. I mean, what in the world would talking about a bureaucratic structure like General Motors, for instance, mean to most Montana people? Don't get me wrong. I don't mean that they couldn't read about it and understand it and absorb it. But as far as any personal impact on them, I think it was probably minor. I used to use in my complex organizations course a number of examples of what we call bureaucratic structures. Any major organization assumes that sort of structure in which leadership at the top filters down, and as you come down the ladder, there get to be more and more people involved and so on. Well, I would take the military as an excellent example. The Catholic Church would be another good example of a bureaucratic structure in another area. And a large industrial organization, dozens of them, of course, in our society. And I think that by taking specific examples of that type of social organization, that it made it more meaningful to students than if you just tried to talk about it in general terms, because most people, even from Montana, have some notion of how the military is put together. I could use the university itself as an example of a structure like that. So I didn't have any problem with it.
How later as you move, as the department grew, were you trying to shape it in a certain way or move it towards something, say having a graduate department,
yeah,
a certain number of students? What would the research emphasis be if that came about, and what successes,
yeah,
did you have? Who were your allies in getting there? Who opposed it?
Well, as the after the three areas in the original department each went its separate way. Then sociology, which was my concern then, began to to develop a shape and a direction that led more and more toward an emphasis on graduate work. We were, from the beginning, essentially an undergraduate teaching department. But as we got more people in, then we got more research interest represented, and we got people who were actually doing research. Dr. Ray Gold, for example, just last year or so published a book on some of the work that he did, and he's working on another book now. More and more graduate level activities came about as more and more faculty people got out in the field and actually gathered data and wrote them up and so on. And so our graduate program began to grow. And at one point, we were listed by the American Sociological Society as one of the five best, however they defined it, master's programs in the country. We had an excellent master's program. And then the administration got interested, I mean the university administration, got interested in building up graduate level activities generally across the campus. And it began to encourage different disciplines to move more in the graduate education direction. As far as we were concerned in sociology, we were asked, I guess we were required, to try to put together a PhD program. History had the same mandate from the administration. And while I wasn't privy to all of the thinking of Main Hall this matter, I know that one of the stimulating concerns was the fact that Bozeman was beginning to strengthen its graduate level work. But at any rate, we were told, in sociology and the people in history were told, and there were other departments involved, to begin to think about a PhD level program. And we did. Obviously, we didn't have the resources in the university to support a PhD program. They're expensive. If you're going to get good students at that level, you got to have something to attract them, and that means you have to have either fellowships or attractive working jobs or teaching graduate assistants or research assistants and so on. And that requires a lot more money than the university had to put into it. So the only way we had to go was to see if we could wangle some money somewhere. And so we put together a training grant request and submitted it to Washington, to the, not sure what they call the specific arm of the health, education, and welfare at that time, But at any rate, we put together this grant request, and they liked it in Washington, and they got together a visiting committee of some of the outstanding people in criminal justice. We were going to emphasize the criminal justice area in our PhD work. And the committee came out and examined the place, interviewed people, and liked what they saw. And so the upshot was that we got a very generous grant. I don't remember what the exact figure, several million dollars. And we were able then to build up the library and hire additional staff and develop some attractive jobs for people coming in, teaching assignments and research assistants and so on. And the upshot was that it was a pretty good program, and we turned out probably about 5 PhDs before our grant ran out. But the trouble with these grants is that they don't have permanent lives. And the university, if it wanted the program to continue, would have to pick it up itself. And of course, there was no way that the university was going to do that. So the PhD program lasted, I suppose, altogether about 5 years. We got an extension and more funds for our grant, training grant, so that the people who were in the pipeline could finish. And I think that we turned out 5, maybe 6 PhDs. Interesting little aside, I had an email from one of my former graduate students in that program who's been teaching at the at Simon Fraser University, and the other day, he's going to be in town next week, next month, and said he looked me up. But at any rate, we turned out good people, and all of our PhD students got jobs in respectable institutions. Kurt, this one I mentioned, went to Simon Fraser. One of them went to one of the Texas University of Texas schools. One went to a research job in Washington. Another one went to a teaching job at the University of South Dakota. So it was a good program.
What was it about the program that you suspect garnered it a 1 of 5 best social departments before that, and then won you the grant in the first place? And what were those PhDs focused on? What was the emphasis?
As I said, our emphasis was on for the PhD level training was on the criminal justice area. And so we developed internship opportunities for students to go to the prison or to some Department of Justice area or something like that. We developed a good fieldwork program to give them practical experience. And it was attractive, I think, from that point of view. We had some very excellent people on the faculty. Very good, the best we could find. And I think that just the combination of factors, it was small, of course, and that's an attractive feature for a lot of people. If the graduate program is too big, the individual students feel sort of lost. Here, everybody worked closely with all the students, and that helped. So it had some good features. But, of course, when the federal money ran out, there was no way that we could continue it. And maybe it's just as well. The thing that's pleased me is that it was very successful while it was working. And I'd much rather see it terminate when adequate support is gone and try to struggle on with inadequate resources. So
You were also involved in a number of other things on the campus besides just the sociology department. You spent time in Main Hall as well, away from being the chair of the sociology department. One thing I'd like for you to talk a bit about is your participation on the Boley Committee, what exactly that was, when it happened.
Yeah, well, the Boley Committee was set up. Here's a lot of material I'm going to turn over to you because there's too much to try to cover here. But it was set up at a time when there was a good bit of unhappiness around the country about some of the practices of the Forest Service, some of the timber harvesting practices. And there were two national forests that were particularly focus of criticism. One was a national forest in West Virginia, and the other one was the Bitterroot National Forest here. And so the congressional delegation from Montana, Senator Metcalf particularly, was interested in having some research done on what the Forest Service was doing and whether there was something to be concerned about and whether there were better ways and so on. And so Congress appointed this committee, which had a long name, a special committee for blah, 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 but it was known as the Boley Committee because Arnold Boley, who was a forestry professor at that time, was chairman. The members of the committee, there were seven of us all together, Boley chairman, Dick Behan from the Forestry Department, Les Pengelly, who was, you probably know about him, from he was in wildlife, Bob Wombat, who was associate dean of forestry then, Tom Paine in political science, Dick Shannon, who was jointly appointed in economics and forestry, and myself. And so we spent a lot of time in the Bitterroot looking at the land, flying over it and walking through it, meeting with the people who were on the ground on the cutting edge of the forestry business in that area. And we identified some particular problems. One of them was clear cutting. The people in the Bitterroot, this might seem sort of minor, but if you live down in the valley and you look up at the mountainside, you don't want to see a lot of bad stuff up there. But this was a time when the Forest Service considered clear-cutting one of its major tools, and their times, and clear-cutting is the best way to go. But anyway, that was one of the things that made the locals unhappy. Another point that we made was that local managers in the Forest Service, the district rangers, didn't have enough control over their own activities. That's stuff that I'll give you enlarges on that. And there were several more areas of that sort that we identified and made some recommendations about. And naturally, it caused a lot of discussion. A lot of the old-time forestry people in particular were unhappy about it. They were particularly unhappy bringing in people from social science to tell them how to run their business, which we weren't trying to do at all. But anyway, it was a lot of activity and lots of meetings and lots of travel to the Bitterroot, and finally we issued a report. Report on the Bitterroot National Forest. That's this one. And I thought I had a copy of the report as it was printed. It appeared I guess in the congressional record, I'm not sure anyway, but there's a copy in the archives. It was written up in a number of magazines as one example in here. So it was considered to be a pretty important thing at the time because it did force people to take another look at resource management. Even professional foresters can make mistakes, and they do have to recognize that change comes about, and if they're going to survive and people are going to be happy with them, they have to change themselves and this sort of thing, sociological stuff, you might call it. It seemed to have been pretty effective. I don't know how you measure the actual impact of this sort of thing, but I think the people in the Bitterroot are happier now with the way Forest Service is operating, and I think that time is going on that the Forest Service people have begun to realize that they might know more about managing forests than anybody else, but they got a people management problem too, and they're aware of that now. So I think it had some salutary effects. It was very interesting, one of the most interesting things I ever got involved in.
How did you get involved in it? You, and I suppose Tom Payne as well from Poli-Sci department. How from those departments were you grouped with these five other people that were involved in wildlife?
I don't know who made the final decisions. Some of us had been working for several years with a school that was used to be given on the campus in the months of January and February called the School for Administrative Leadership that brought in some 30 or 40 middle management level people from resource management agencies, the Forest Service, the BLM, the Soil Conservation, Bureau of Indian Affairs, and so on, so that I and Dick Shannon and Tom Payne, who worked with this school, had some credibility, if I can put it that way, already with resource management people. I mean, they knew who we were and what we represented. And my guess is that when the time came for whoever made the decisions back in Washington, talked to Lee Metcalf or maybe people on the campus and said, now who do you have that you'd suggest? And we got recommended. I mean, it could have been five other people, but it ended up with us. And the group worked well together. And the Forest Service people were, even though tough on them sometimes, but they were very cooperative. And it was a good experience. I think it did a lot of good. So I'm going to give you this, and when you're through with it, if you want to give it to archives, do so.
How did the university as a whole, or the administration, or Main Hall, view this committee, which I assume was primarily academic?
These were all academic
but
people.
Clearly would be viewed by a lot as fairly activist.
Yeah, I suppose so. Although I don't remember that there was ever any particular point made of that. I sensed, and I guess all of us did, that here was a group of experts, professionally trained people, who were doing a day-by-day job of managing resources. And here was a bunch of college professors over here, you know, who float around in outer space and really don't know much about the practical aspects. And you could sense sometimes that this professionally trained group were a little suspicious of us academicians. But all of us had been working with resource management people for a good many years, and we had a pretty honest give-and-take relationship with them, and they with us. And so there really wasn't as much of this suspicion that you're suggesting as you might think. That was some of it, no question about it. And we had a Society of American Foresters had a local chapter after the Boley report came out, had a meeting here to discuss it, and well-attended meeting. So we all of us who'd been on the committee turned up, and that was some pretty frank, some pretty frank criticism from both sides. And that was one of the most entertaining meetings I've attended. should be doing a lot more than we. We lose so much.